Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Every 3 decades or so, the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio gathers its members for a statewide convention, and those members will descend on Columbus this weekend for that purpose. So we invited a few to the show to talk about the organization, its reputation, how it's changed, and not its reputation, but how it's changed and what's on the platter these days. Joining us later on will be OSU Moritz College of Law professor, Professor Tokaji, and right now we have the ACLU Ohio's longtime executive director, Christine Link, with us. Christine, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
This is the first time Christine and I have ever faced each other in person, so we've been talking on the phone, however, for about 20 years, so it's a big day for us. And also, OSU Moritz College of Law Professor Emeritus David Goldberger. He's a former legal and legislative director of the Illinois Division of the ACLU. David won his first case before the U.S. Supreme Court in the well-known case Nationalist Socialist Party of America versus the Village of Skokie, as in Illinois. Glad you could join us.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk about the big news first. Yesterday, a federal judge ruled in the Arizona immigration case. You want to talk about that and give us some response? Yeah.
Such an important case, just to have this injunction so that the process can move ahead, but without the burden of these terrible regulations on both the people and law enforcement.
The injunction affects the most what you would consider the most onerous parts of the law.
That's correct.
People who are immigrants have to always have proof of identification on them.
Yes.
Which would mean almost everyone has to have proof of identification.
Right, because they would be able, anytime they pull you over, they could ask anybody for it. Right.
I heard Arnold Schwarzenegger speak recently, and he said, look, with my accent, they're going to want to see my papers. Right. So every American is now vulnerable, is this sort of thing picks up some traction in different parts of the country.
But it was only a state law. Why should people in Ohio care or pay attention?
Well, a partner, a mirror image of that legislation has been introduced in Ohio. So we have a lot of reason to worry. Also, we have a state essentially usurping the authority and responsibility of the federal government to make these laws. We can't have 50 different immigration laws in this country. It'll be crazy.
There's an organization out there. It's called Stop ACLU, and one of their top 10 reasons for stopping the ACLU was that the ACLU advocates open borders.
Every country has a right to control its borders. That almost goes without saying. The question is, do we do it in a way that is fair and equitable and sensible? In this particular, what's happening in Arizona is really a failure of political leadership to create good public policy. We needn't have this kind of situation, but Congress year after year has refused to embark on meaningful immigration reform.
Now, David, in Arizona, this is an injunction. It's temporary at this point.
Right.
What's the next step in the process, and what is it at this level of the game, what is it? What kind of message is it sending?
Well, the next step will be to either handle the whole matter after a trial or, I assume, on full briefing with evidence that the parties may agree to submit to the court so that there can be a final ruling on the constitutionality of the statute. This is just a preliminary ruling that says that the judge says that there's a substantial likelihood of success on the part of the challengers and Justice Department in this case and others that have joined. And in light of that, it's a temporary injunction putting the statute on hold until the case can be adjudicated completely on the merits. So that's where it's at procedurally.
And to have a judge rule this way at this point is a pretty
If she's saying she thinks that there's a substantial likelihood that the statute is unconstitutional.
And she has to be able to show that herself, right? The judge does. It's just not like willy-nilly. You can't just say that.
No, she has to – based on the arguments of the parties and the – I assume the – if there was evidence or affidavits, I would suspect in this case – that explain why the enforcement of the statute would be harmful and disruptive in terms of federal interests and therefore create a constitutional problem. You know, after that, the statute essentially has to be, you know, she said that it has to be held in abeyance or else it'll do all the things that the Justice Department's concerned about.
We are talking with some representatives from the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio, Christine Link, the executive director of the ACLU of Ohio, David Goldberger. He is a Moritz College of Law professor emeritus. Coming up later, Dan Tokashi of the OSU Moritz College of Law as well. He's an associate professor there. We're talking about the news of the day right now, though, as long as we've got him in the studio. And one other big item of news is the crack cocaine disparity bill has passed the House and the Senate, and it's on its way to the president for his signature. Tell us about that, Christine.
Finally, after many, many years of studies and recognizing that the treatment of sentencing in federal crimes involving cocaine and crack have been based on a system that is fundamentally disparate in its treatment by race. Cocaine found more frequently among whites and crack more frequently among African Americans. This ends that disparity in sentencing so that the two crimes are treated basically the same.
The sentencing was a big problem, right?
So it's a significant problem, and it is kind of the tip of the iceberg for sentencing throughout the criminal justice system. We'll be talking about this at great length at our conference on Saturday. It's probably our flagship issue in Ohio is the need to repair and update and eliminate racial disparities and income disparities in the criminal justice system, which are extensive, and they reach everybody from people charged with misdemeanors all the way up through death penalty charges.
But they're not overt. It doesn't say, depending on what color you are, this is the kind of the way the law is going to be leveled.
Basically a wacky law because it says crack cocaine, a crack cocaine violation gets an enormous sentence, and a cocaine violation gets a substantially less sentence when essentially it's the same substance.
Just used differently, different places.
And it happens to be the fact that it's crack is used more frequently by drug abusers in the ghetto, and regular cocaine is used more frequently by drug abusers who are not in the ghettos. But the underlying distinction is simply irrational. I mean, it seemed plausible at the time, I suppose, that somehow everybody thought that crack was the equivalent of international terrorism, and so they, you know, lowered the hammer on it. But as it played out, it was pretty clear that it was simply a variety of cocaine and that the differences in sentencing were enormous.
Now, the president has said he will sign the bill. Do we know?
I haven't heard that. I would expect so.
It's my understanding that he plans to sign it.
Okay. All righty then. Why a conference now? When I was talking to your communications director when he first called me and notified me of the conference, I said it was billed as the first ever. And I said, the first ever? He said, well, no one can really remember when the last one was. There probably was a last one. Someone thinks maybe 30 years ago or something like that. Why now? What inspired it?
Well, and it's a broad-based membership conference. We've done smaller issues things over the years on privacy, on identity theft, on national security. But this conference, I think 36 workshops and 100 speakers of all kinds of backgrounds, and some notable national figures will be there. Mary Beth Tinker, the principal in Tinker v. Des Moines, which was the—
What, you know, just to help out there, what Chris means when she says the principal, she means the main party, not the principal of the school.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. principal litigant.
For those of us of a certain age, we remember the Tinker case firsthand because Mary Beth was the 13 or 14-year-old girl who wore a black armband to school to protest the Vietnam War and was suspended along with her, I think, little brother. In addition, we've got the director of the Drug Policy Alliance coming. This is an organization whose primary goal is to work to decriminalize drug laws. And Louise Melling from the National ACLU, previously the head of the Reproductive Rights Project for us. In addition to that, an array of notable speakers, including Dan and David, both have jobs there.
Stop ACLU said that the ACLU has been laying low lately, and this doesn't sound like you're laying low. In fact, when I was reading up about the Ohio ACLU, it sounds like it's thriving.
Yeah, that's rather odd because perusing the papers yesterday, we appeared in the Cleveland Plain Dealer in USA Today. I think we were in the Wall Street Journal the day before. So the idea that we're laying low is kind of a giggle.
What? So you've got this conference coming up. How do you decide what your priorities are for a conference like this when it's a statewide?
It's very difficult because the Bill of Rights, of course, covers a broad scope of issues, everything from national security and renditions, the death penalty, the school-to-prison pipeline where children with learning disabilities or children of color are much more likely to be directed toward detention and consequently develop police records later on. So we have a wide range of issues to cover, and the conference really only gets us perhaps 10% of the way. We try to respond on two levels. What's big in public policy, what's going to move. And in Ohio, there's a huge interest in the size of our prison system and its expense and the lack of fairness in the system. So we've got several workshops devoted to that.
Okay. We're going to take a break. Christine and David will return after the next segment coming up. Dan Tokaji, he is an OSU Moritz College of Law associate professor. We'll talk about some of the things that divide folks in the ACLU with him and just probably a few other things as well, I imagine, if I know Dan. So stay tuned. We'll take calls, emails, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your remarks there. We're glad to hear what you have to say. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. At 1 o'clock, On Point will be here. Problems with the news after the Shirley Sherrod fiasco. On Point looks at the quality of our national information flow. What's news and what's propaganda? That discussion on Point at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories heard on WOSU comes from the law firm of Porter, Wright, Morris, and Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.
76 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:19 this morning. A few clouds lingering throughout the morning, along with a slight chance of rain. And then some sunshine this afternoon, a high of 85. Clear skies tonight and a low of 60 degrees. Sunny for Friday morning, a few clouds in the afternoon, and a high of 82. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I was wrong. Dan Tokaji will be with us this segment, but so will David Goldberger, OSU Moritz College of Law Professor Emeritus, and Christine Link, the Executive Director of the ACLU of Ohio. So, it's hail, hail, the gang's all here. Dan, what we were going to talk about in this segment is the fact that the ACLU is not monolithic. There are differences of opinion in the group about sometimes about its direction in general, but also about different issues and different cases.
Absolutely. The ACLU, and I should say as a matter of disclosure, I was an ACLU attorney for 8 years in Southern California and until very recently was a member of the board of the ACLU of Ohio. The ACLU is internally an incredibly diverse organization. People have a multiplicity of views and a multiplicity of different conception of what civil liberties issues are. And if you go back and look at the history of the ACLU, you'll see that that has always been the case since its founding 90 years ago. And by the way, for those interested in learning about that history, there's an outstanding book, the second edition of which was published 10 years ago by Sam Walker, called In Defense of American History In Defense of American Liberties, which is the definitive history of the organization. So, you know, over the course of time, the ACLU has moved from an organization that was predominantly concerned with freedom of speech to an organization that is focused on a number of other issues as well, including race discrimination, the right to vote, sex discrimination, equality for gays and lesbians. I could go on, but there has been an evolving conception of civil liberties, just as over the course of time there has been an evolving conception of the Constitution and what it requires. And I think one of the biggest issues that exists today, and an issue on which there's disagreement among people in this room, is on the extent to which the ACLU should be concerned with more traditional issues of individual liberty as opposed to systemic issues of equality, such as social and economic justice. And just to provide my perspective, mm-hmm. which tends toward a view that we should be concerned about those issues, I think it's important to look at where we are in American history and what the biggest problems that our society faces today. If we look at the last three decades, we've seen an alarming expansion of the gap between rich and poor, not just rich and poor, but rich and working people in this country. I could go through numbers, but to just give you one, the income gap has increased threefold in the last three decades as between the top 1% and the bottom 20%. The racial gap in wealth has increased at an even more alarming rate, and this creates inequalities in all sorts of areas of American life, including education, housing, and one of my main concerns, access to the political process, where people who are wealthy and corporate interests have a much bigger say in the laws that get passed by Congress and state legislative bodies than do poor people or ordinary working people.
Corporations are people, according to the U.S.
So the Supreme Court has said, but I think the Citizens United decision, the decision that came out earlier this year to which you refer, this is a decision that said corporations have speech rights and that the government can't limit corporate expenditures in support of or opposition to political candidates under the First Amendment. This is really just the tip of the iceberg and a problem that didn't begin with Citizens United but has been going on for a long time, which is that the Supreme Court has failed to recognize that there's an interest in political equality and ensuring that all citizens have an equal say in the decisions that are made by government.
So is your concern that the ACLU isn't embracing those issues alone, or that they're not including them among the many, many issues that the ACLU does work on?
Well, you know, look, I'm a card-carrying ACLU member.
Right.
And I think that on all of the issues we've discussed and the various other issues that are on the docket of the ACLU of Ohio, I'm not sure I could find a case with which I disagree. So, you know, my concern is to make sure that the ACLU is looking forward toward the future. And just as, you know, if we look back 90 years, we really did face a crisis of free speech. It was common for the government to raid groups to suppress speech that it didn't like. And 90 years later, I think it's – we can agree that the United States is in a much, much better position when it comes to free speech. Maybe at the margins we might disagree with some decisions from the Supreme Court, but generally speaking, freedom of speech is in a pretty healthy state today, thanks in no small part to the ACLU. My interest is really not so much to criticize what's happened mm-hmm. in the past, but to look forward towards the future and to the civil liberties issues that are going to confront us in the future. And again, you know, there are different conceptions of civil liberties, but I'm really very concerned with the extent to which inequalities in wealth and income can lead to a violation of our basic rights and liberties as American citizens, including the right to equal participation in our government.
David?
There's I share, I think, Dan's overall values as to what's good and what's bad for America. My view of the ACLU is a very different one because essentially I believe that the Civil Liberties Union has been and should remain a civil liberties organization, that the social justice approach that I think that Dan articulates would turn the ACLU into a social welfare organization and make it indistinguishable from other organizations trying to deal with problems of poverty problems with the environment and so forth. And it becomes essentially an organization which doesn't include people from all parts of the political spectrum, because these are much more ideological issues that I don't think really are solved by the Constitution. They're basically solved by views of what social justice is and should be.
But let me respond to that by saying, look, the ACLU, at least not for a long time, has been limited by the Constitution as understood by the current Supreme Court. And we have often fought not only for constitutional right but for civil rights protected by statutes like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. We have also not engaged only in litigation but in reform through the legislative process. And I would question the proposition that this is really as radical as David might make it sound, although he certainly didn't use that word. Look,
give me an example, though, Dan, of what you're talking about
in terms
of social justice. Give me a tight example of what the ACLU could do.
Absolutely.
And
you know, I say the ACLU by and large has not been concerned with these issues, but there are certainly exceptions. And I'm going to give you a couple of ACLU cases that I think represent exceptions. In California, the ACLU, the Northern California chapters, a few years ago brought a massive piece of litigation to reform California's educational system to address the effects of the wealth and income disparities that I've talked about and to ensure that they don't lead to unequal educational opportunities for children of all races, white, black, Latino, Asian American. California chapters have also engaged in extensive litigation, not just under the Constitution but under California statutory law on the rights of homeless people to housing, right? This is not, I would say, a traditional civil liberties issue in the sense that it goes beyond the government leaving you alone. It's a claim that you have an affirmative right to assistance from the government. I'd also question David's suggestion that there are a lot of other organizations that are out there working on these issues. The fact of the matter is that the ACLU over the past 90 years has become the big dog in the public interest community when it comes to litigation and legislative advocacy. And our conception of civil liberties has evolved and generally expanded over the course of time. And you know, to the claim that this is something that would be a polarizing issue, look, all the issues the ACLU takes on are polarizing issues. It's partly a reflection of how our society has changed over the years that the ACLU has been in existence. But I don't think that we should be deterred by the fact that our taking certain positions would trigger opposition in some quarters.
Yeah, see, and Dan gives two examples. One, I heartily agree with him on, and that's school funding. We had that issue here in Ohio where you had such disparate mm-hmm. School funding as you move from the rich suburban districts to the poor rural districts and some of the poor urban districts, that the effect was to really deprive kids in those poorer districts of meaningful access to
– In other words, a public policy that was leading specifically to the disparities.
Well, that's right. It was essentially the structure of the state tax laws and how school funding was set up under the laws, and that created serious, in my view, constitutional problems under the Equal Protection Clause, among others. Now, on the other hand, the right to housing assistance, I believe that people who need housing assistance ought to have it, but I just don't think that it's the ACLU's business. that one of the reasons that Dan can characterize us as the big dog, I'm not sure that that's – I wish we were big dog.
Well, actually, Stop ACLU calls you a Goliath.
Well, that's why I just
– Depends on who you compare us to, I
say.
Suppose, right?
Compare us to the NRA and you've got –
But you know, in comparison with other public interest organizations that do the kind of work that we do, which is, you know, mainly litigation and legislative advocacy as well as public education, I don't think there's any organization in the country that compares to the ACLU.
So what they've done in Northern California with the ACLU chapter there, that is not necessarily something Ohio would do, and it varies between the states?
Right. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Ohio's long-standing reputation has been it's kind of the hard line on First Amendment cases. That's the place where we've really excelled. But there's also this kind of regional difference in a lot of ways. What Dan has expressed is basically a position that you hear an awful lot from our sister affiliates on the West Coast, that the ACLU should be drawn into more issues of economic justice. And I tend to agree with Dan on everything that he says until he gets to his conclusion, that's the job of the ACLU. Yeah. The things that he's talking about are the and this is, you know, off the ACLU agenda. Mm-hmm. They are the result of unregulated capitalism. We are the democracy organization. We're not the capitalism organization.
And yet a lot of times another criticism I often see when I go to chat rooms and that kind of thing of the ACLU is that you're a bunch of commie pinkos. You've seen it before. I've literally seen that phrase in the last few days. And it is seen as an organization that battles on behalf of people in terms of economics.
Let me just recount a conversation I had years ago. I once represented the Communist Party of Illinois to get them on the ballot. And I was talking to their local director of the organization, and he was and because he was a client, you know, I'd spent some time with him working on the case, so it was very informal. And he talked about the virtues of communism, and I said, "Well, you know, Joe, that if you were in charge, I'd probably be in jail." And there was a long pause, and he said, "You're probably right."
And let me be very clear on this, because I think, you know, there actually is a line of agreement here that I want to focus on, which is, look, my argument is not contrary to what David suggests, that the ACLU should be a social welfare organization. My argument is that we should prevent these vast inequalities of income and wealth that exist in our society from affecting opportunities in areas like education, housing, and most important to me, the political process. And
Dan,
this gets me to a disagreement with the longstanding, although it's recently changed, ACLU policy on campaign finance regulation. The ACLU has long taken the position that money is speech, and I think there's certainly at least a kernel of truth to that. In order to express your views in the political process, it takes money. But the corollary of that is that those who don't have a lot of money to spend in support of their preferred candidates don't have a voice, certainly don't have an equal voice in our democracy. And that, I think, to be a serious problem with the longstanding ACLU position in the area of campaign finance regulation, its failure to recognize political equality as a constitutional value.
Something's changed, though, Dan. You said the ACLU has changed.
Well, there's some I get the feeling that there's – that the ACLU original position was to oppose all campaign finance laws down the line. And I gather that position is starting, at least for the most part, and is now starting to show shades of gray.
There's discussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some tools of regulating influence in campaigns that we have supported. For instance, the return of free television and equal time would be an enormous step forward, because that is, after all, where the majority of the money is spent. And what we lost in the so-called Reagan Revolution was this idea that the airways belonged to the people. And now they belong to corporations, and consequently the ability to speak has become extremely expensive because the government no longer allocates a certain amount of time to public discourse, to campaign speech. And I think that's something that we could retrieve, and it would take us much closer to this idea of political equality that Dan has given voice to.
And I agree with the reforms that Chris just mentioned. I think that would be a step in the right direction. But we can't address the rampant inequalities in access to the political process without getting at the money problem. And this is, I think, why there's been such a show of outrage in response to the Citizens United decision. There's, I think, consensus across the political spectrum that wealthy corporate interests shouldn't be allowed to dominate our political discourse.
Also, campaign finance disclosure laws.
Yeah.
The ACLU has a position on those?
Reporting
laws, yeah. I guess, is better.
You know, I should let David address this because it's a tricky
– It's a nuanced, it's a nuanced area of law.
I think that the ACLU supports the requirements, as I understand it, supports campaign finance disclosure, except where – that disclosure will result in retaliation against donors. I mean, when
so if people want to be anonymous donors to protect their personal welfare.
Well, there has to be evidence that they're really at risk of harassment or something like that.
I find it a very interesting issue. It gets to the gun issue, for instance.
Right.
We have always opposed the idea of massive gun registration, because it gives the government then a list of everybody who owns a gun. In the same way, you have to be a little skeptical of absolute requirement of all disclosure, because then
right.
when you get a political leader like Richard Nixon who wants to seek out retribution from his political enemies, the government has that list of who's
right.
been giving.
I mean, I think this is one of the many areas in which we all should acknowledge there are competing democratic values at stake. On the one hand is the interest in information and in disclosure, in knowing who is behind a multi-million dollar ad campaign for or against a candidate or an initiative. There's a real democratic interest in knowing who's responsible for certain speech. On the other hand, if we get down to lower level contributions, there may be risks of retaliation. And you know, the classic case is a case that the ACLU was involved in. NAACP was the chief litigant involving the disclosure of NAACP membership lists. And you know, I think there's no substantial risk of undue influence arising from some grandmother who's giving a $5 contribution. On the other hand, if we have people pumping massive amounts into our political system to influence not only who gets elected to office, but the policies that are enacted by our legislative bodies afterwards, that's a really significant concern for democracy.
We have to take a break right now, and when we return, we'll talk about more of this stuff and maybe the top 10 reasons to stop the ACLU. Take a stroll down that road. If you want to comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It is the time for a statewide conference of the ACLU of Ohio. They're meeting this weekend, and that's why we're talking with them today. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features over 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about Ohio's musical history and the contribution of folk song collector Ann Grimes. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU. Currently 77 degrees in downtown Columbus, a few clouds lingering this morning with a slight chance of rain, and then sunshine this afternoon and a high of 85. Clear skies tonight and a low of 60 degrees. Expect some sunshine Friday morning, a few clouds in the afternoon, and a high of 82. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Discover more about WOSU Public Media at our website, WOSU.org. You can sign up for the Daily News Loop for updates sent right to your inbox. Get the best in trusted WOSU and NPR news and information every weekday. Sign up for it at WOSU.org. And All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. As I mentioned earlier, the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio gathers its members for a statewide convention this weekend. And joining us today, OSU Moritz College of Law Professor Emeritus David Goldberger. Also, Christine Link. She's the longtime executive director of ACLU Ohio. And with us as well in the studio is Dan Tokaji. He is an associate professor of law at the Moritz College of Law. I wanted to go over these top 10 reasons to stop the ACLU because I thought it was just a really handy-dandy guide to a lot of the criticisms you see of the ACLU generally. Dan, did you want to say something?
No, go ahead. I'm waiting in eager anticipation of hearing that.
I don't know whether to start with the number one or we've already been on number six, which is the ACLU advocates open borders. You've already responded to that, Christine. I guess we could start with number 10, just for the fun of it, that the ACLU was founded by a communist.
Roger Baldwin, our founder, was a social worker from St. Louis. He was a conscientious objector during World War I. He spent, I think, 3 or 4 years in federal prison for his beliefs about peace. He and a group of friends started the ACLU. What people don't realize is that in the teens and 20s in this country, it was against the law to discuss labor unions. Right. It was against the law to discuss family planning. The Ohio ACLU was founded in Youngstown, Ohio in 1917 in an effort to protect the rights of workers in the steel mills who were attempting to organize labor unions.
And is that where that
that First that Amendment passion
glaze
comes from.
Of the where the socialism and the communism, is that where that came from?
I think
because
labor
a lot of
unions,
labor union organizers
because,
at the time.
Because Roger Baldwin was sticking up for the rights of workers. And you know, at the time, anybody who did that was at least in some quarters labeled a socialist or a communist.
Right.
And later on, the ACLU would go on to defend the speech rights of demonstrators during the civil rights movement, and similar labels were applied to those people.
Yeah, keep in mind that that co-founders or other individuals instrumental in the founding included Felix Frankfurter, who was a mind-bogglingly conservative Supreme Court justice after he got to the court. So that the suggestion that it was a communist founded or communist organization is simply it's simply unfounded.
The ACLU number nine. The ACLU does not believe in the Second Amendment. Now, Christine, you mentioned earlier that you oppose mass registration of guns in the United States. Is that it, or is there more to?
Well, we are once again tortured by the Second Amendment, and there's a range of opinion within the organization. Mm-hmm. Until the recent Supreme Court decision, our position was that the right to own a gun was a group right. The Second Amendment references the militia.
Right.
Now, in light of the latest Supreme Court decision, there's a reevaluation going on.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with at least a part of the Supreme Court's decision. I actually think the Supreme Court was right to, as we say in the law, incorporate the Second Amendment, meaning to hold that the Second Amendment applies to the states as well as to the federal government, just as other provisions of the Bill of Rights have been incorporated. I don't really There's disagreement on this issue, but I don't see a principled basis for distinguishing the Second Amendment from other amendments. But the real issue is what exactly the Second Amendment should be interpreted to mean. And I think that the Supreme Court should ultimately adopt a test that allows some balancing of interests. It's not an absolute ban on any regulations regarding firearms.
Just to add to the rainbow here, you've heard two views, and to see there's no unanimity, I think the Supreme Court got it dead wrong.
Okay. We have an email from Bruce. Writes, "Oh, how I wish we were a Goliath instead of a collection of disparate and desperate Lilliputians." talk about the need to fight the good fight on campaign finance! Exclamation mark. Sorry, I will miss the event, but have a great conference.
Some of us have illusions of grandeur, I suppose.
And we have Mark on the phone right now. Mark, welcome to the show. You have a question for Professor David Goldberg.
Professor, I actually had the pleasure of having the professor in a I think it was a constitutional law class back in 1984. But I wanted to ask this question, Ben, and I didn't get a chance to, on the Skokie case. I just don't understand. You know, you have the KKK, which is a terrorist organization, and they intentionally pick a community that has a large percentage of the, not only Jews, but Jews who went through the Holocaust. Isn't that intentionally insightful by the CIA to pick Skokie? I mean, why couldn't they have had their march in Chicago or a city that, you know, where they can make the same point that they support white power or whatever their point is, but it doesn't have to be intentionally in your face as it was? And I remember when the professor, since I graduated, I've seen clips of him on Phil Donahue, and a gentleman stood up and asked him a question who was a Holocaust survivor, and I could tell it threw the professor off. That's why people don't like the ACLU. I mean, it almost seemed to surprise you. And I was thinking, what did you expect?
Professor?
Well, it seems to me that the we don't have the time to straighten out. There's some mistakes about the facts, but the fact is that there wasn't the Nazi National Socialist Party of America, which was a splinter Nazi party, who that wanted to picket in front of the village hall. And yes, they can go anyplace else, but when you have a public forum, it doesn't make any difference where that public forum is. Everyone has the same right to use that public forum. And you can use the very same argument to say that and Chicago tried and fortunately lost. Let me finish.
Let him finish, Mark.
They said this a black group that wanted to march through the Nazi area in Chicago, the area where the headquarters was, and there were a lot of sympathetic neighbors, that they had no right to go there. And again, why didn't they go someplace else to express their protests against the Nazis? And the bottom line was the courts in both cases said these are public places. Everyone has an equal right to it so long as what they are doing is constitutionally protected.
And let me add something. I think David was absolutely right to defend the speech rights of the Nazis in Skokie. His position, I think, has been vindicated over time. Maybe there's not complete unanimity on that position, but among most people, David is a hero for what he did in defending the First Amendment. And it's a sign to me that the ACLU has to put aside the public opinion of the moment in deciding what cases it takes.
Mark, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. You do have to make some tough decisions sometimes. I'm just going to just make a leap here and say you're not supporters of the Nazi Party.
No, we're not.
Right.
We're not supporters of the Republican or the Democratic Party either.
Right. Let's see. Do you hate the Boy Scouts? Because number 8 in the Stop ACLU list of reasons to stop the ACLU is their outright hatred of the Boy Scouts. Of course, this has to do with, the LGBT community, mm-hmm. and the banning of gay members in the organization.
This is based on a case that came out of, I believe, New Jersey a number of years ago regarding the Boy Scouts ban on LGBT people being volunteers, working under an erroneous assumption that somehow LGBT people pose some kind of threat to the membership of the Boy Scouts. We're neutral on the Boy Scouts, as we are with all of these groups. We neither approve nor disapprove of them. It is their action and their treatment of others that we had a problem with. In this case, they implemented discriminatory practices. They're also not based on fact.
Okay. We have another call. And I think it's, yeah, Ralph, you like the ACLU.
Yes, I love the ACLU, and because it represents organizations that I find very sickening, that I totally disagree with, and that I find abhorrent. And but they're not representing the organization; they are representing the right of that organization, and the fact that they are representing the rights for whoever comes along, and in whatever place is public. That's why I love it, and that's really all I had to say.
Okay. Thanks, Ralph.
Thank you.
Number seven, the ACLU is pro-death. Not only is the ACLU pro-abortion, it's the ACLU's top priority. It most definitely takes a backseat to free speech for the ACLU. As a matter of fact, well, it just goes on and on.
Well, again, we're neutral on abortion. Have an abortion, don't have an abortion, we don't care. What we care about is the basic principle that says the government should not be involved in private and personal decision-making. So whom you marry, whom you fall in love with, whether or not to have a child, those are all private issues that don't need government regulation.
Let me speak from a kind of a different, slightly different vantage point. I think it's fair to say that there are some of us, and that includes me, in the ACLU, that believe that abortion is a bad thing, but that it's a personal choice, and that notwithstanding the fact that I personally think it's not a good thing, people have to make those choices for themselves because it's about themselves.
And let me add to this a point that was made by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was a former ACLU attorney and a fantastic lawyer who made a huge difference in the area of women's rights. It's also a women's rights issue. It's an issue of fundamental equality and not just of privacy, that reproductive rights has everything to do with women's ability to achieve equal status in the United States in the employment sector and in all other walks of American life.
A couple of why to stop the ACLU reasons. One is the ACLU opposes national security. The ACLU has opposed almost every effort in the arena of national security, from the bird flu to bag searches. And then that's number four. Number three is the ACLU defends the enemy, and they're talking about the PLO in 1985, Gaddafi in the 80s.
Well, they could be talking about the Japanese internment as well. And I should disclose that my father, when he was a boy, was among those who was interned at Manzanar, one of the so-called relocation camps. And the ACLU, after a furious internal debate, represented those who were challenging in court the evacuation and detention of Japanese American citizens as well as Japanese nationals in the United States. The ACLU ultimately lost those cases, including the infamous Korematsu case. But I think in the end, we've come to see those decisions in wrong. And actually, the Korematsu decision, some good has come from it in the sense that it is what ultimately led to the recognition that classifications based on race or ethnicity are inimical to the Constitution. And so the ACLU has always been accused of being subversive or anti-patriotic when it defends the rights of those who in the national security crisis of the moment are accused of being disloyal.
I think subversive is a good word. That is a word that pops up a lot. And is it because of these kinds of cases largely?
Oh, I think certainly is. Dan has pointed out, and you can look earlier in history and then later, you know, the popular groups don't need us. We're here for the people who are unpopular, who have a minority opinion, or they're of the minority race, or they're out of favor with popular thinking of the time. You know, in recent times, we've been involved in the representation of Muslim people and people of Middle Eastern or Arab descent consistently, because the hammer of the government has fallen on them in a disproportionate and unfair, fundamentally unfair way. So that's what we're here for.
Let's just jump to number one, because we don't have a lot of time left. The ACLU fulfills its agenda using my tax money. That is the number one reason to stop the ACLU, according to Stop the ACLU, which is a website that I was looking at this morning. So the ACLU fulfills its agenda using my tax money?
Never. First of all, our job is to sue the government. So the government doesn't give us money to sue the government. Our work is conducted based on our members' contributions.
So funding comes from solely
private. There's no or little foundation funding even. It's all individual.
It's all in the form of contributions. It's, in fact, I think Dan and I are both, I'm a former staff person, Dan's a former staff person, Chris is a staff person. I've always had a great deal of pride in the fact that we're an organization that can say that the government cannot influence our decisions by saying, well, if you don't do it a particular way, we're not going to give you a subsidy. We can say we're not asking for a subsidy and we don't take the won't take the money, so we can criticize whenever we think it's appropriate.
Okay.
For people interested in attending the conference this weekend, that's still a possibility. You can go to our website at acluohio.org.
Okay, and we'll post it on our website at wosu.org/allsides. I want to say thank you to my guests, Christine Link, Executive Director of the ACLU of Ohio. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Also, David Goldberger, OSU Moritz College of Law, Professor Emeritus. David, glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And Dan Tokaji, OSU Moritz College of Law Professor. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's all the time we have for this episode. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.